guys, here we go. She Runs Ultras, episode number 35. And in this episode, I want to introduce you to my friend Heather because, well, basically, she's a badass. She's a former police officer, an ultra runner, and she's about to embark on a pretty epic adventure. I don't want to say too much and give it all away, but suffice it to say that we had tons of fun chatting, and I'm excited for you all to hear this conversation because I know it's not only going to resonate with a lot of you, but it's also going to inspire you to commit or maybe even recommit to your ultra challenges. So without further ado, here's my chat with Heather.
All right, you guys. So here we go. I have brought Heather on to chat with us today about like a whole bunch of stuff. And as I mentioned in the intro, Heather and I go back, we have run ragged together, and I didn't tell her I was going to tell you guys this story, but I was a huge fan of Heather because she has the best power walking you have ever seen. Like, I remember being out on the course at Ragged and seeing this person in front of me just motoring up this hill. And I was like, first of all, I have to catch this woman because there's nobody else out on the course. And I think it was maybe year one, and I didn't really know where I was going. So I was like, I got to follow her because if I miss a turn, like I'm going to follow this person. And I just couldn't catch her. Like I legit, Heather, I couldn't catch you. And then I had to run and you were just, you know, power walking. And then when I got there, I like introduced myself and I was like, yeah, you're fast. Like you're a super fast power
That was our moment.
That was how we met and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah.
But they don't have the benefit of knowing you. So I would love for you to just give us like the quick and dirty, like who is Heather? What's kind of your background with running? How did you get here? And then we'll sure. dive into like some of the other cool stuff that you have going on. So
all right.
Tell us about
Sounds
Heather.
Good. So it's funny when you sent me the sort of the outline of what we were going to talk about, I laughed because my introduction to running was, I would say, non-traditional. I was 32, 33 when I decided that I just felt like crap. I had been, at that point, I had been a police officer for 12 years. I had been working evenings, nights, weekends, holidays, and I just didn't feel great. And I came from a background where I didn't play sports. I rode horses. So I didn't have to worry about my fitness as a kid or as a teenager, even into my early 20s. I, you know, everything I ate just went right, you know, it went right back into energy and to working with these big, amazing animals. And then as my career progressed, I got away from riding competitively. And here comes the weight. Here comes the bad food. So I really needed to change my lifestyle. So I thought to myself, running would be a good way to condition myself so that I could hike because I had wanted to get back out on the trails and I'd done a little bit of hiking in my early 20s. So I figured there's no better way than to start running to get a little bit of condition so that I could start hiking. And that just, I went down the rabbit hole with that. So it started with some 5Ks. Then it went to let's do a race series. And along the way, I experienced some injuries like everybody does. You know, had to figure out what worked for my body, what worked for me. Because I thrive with a plan and with some focus, I signed up for a 10K group that was being hosted in Portsmouth at Runner's Alley. And that was 2012. And I remember at the time having a conversation with a friend and that person saying, oh, you're going to end up running a half marathon someday. I was like, no, I'm not. No way. So fast forward. And since that time, I've fallen in love with trail running. I've fallen in love with the mountains. And I'm really a choose your own adventure kind of girl. So everything that I do is adventure driven. That's how I got to where I am today.
So talk to us like, so you did the 10K, you did the half marathon, kind of yep. go through the progression, like what are the distances that you've gotten to thus far? And then what yep. do you maybe like have on the horizon?
Sure. So, 5K, 10K, half marathon on the road, That eventually led to some trail running. We have some great local trails out here, so I was introduced to trail running. It was hard, so naturally I liked it. I should say I'm that middle of the pack runner. I tend to run at the back of the middle of the pack. I'll never be the front of the pack. I'm never going to win. So because of that, I have to enjoy it for other reasons. So I got into trail running. Along the way, I started hiking, which was nice. So 4,000 footers, not seriously, not chasing a list or anything, but started climbing. And what that led to was a desire to try the 50K distance. I skipped right over marathon distance, went right to 50K. At that point, I was training myself. So I did what everybody does. I downloaded the plan. Mm-hmm. And I really benefited from capitalizing on my walk, like you were talking about earlier.
I'm so glad that we're on this. I want to pause on this for a second because I think like there's a lot of people, I've gotten a lot of DMs and some emails. I am also of the opinion that you don't have to do a marathon before you do a 50K. And so I didn't know this about you. So I'm super psyched about this, but like, you know, you're living proof that you don't have to do that. And I think there's a lot of, like, I'd be interested to hear how that kind of went for you. You know, did you do a marathon on your way to 50K, like in your training, or did you just kind of like skip right over that and just go, yep, 50K?
I actually skipped right over it. The longest training run that I did was 24 miles. And what I did was I employed a strategy of walk-run intervals. Nice. So my race day plan, and it was the Pineland 50K was the first one that I did.
I love Pineland. I'm so sad that it doesn't exist anymore.
I know.
I've done all the distances there.
Same. It has a soft spot in my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually 25K was the first distance I did at Pineland, and it was a mud fest. And then
As always.
I knew I loved the course. So I was like, let's go back. So my plan was to use a walk run strategy. So my race day plan that I trained for was run 2 minutes, walk 30 seconds the whole way through. And I had told myself that if I needed a little bit more rest, I could take it. But if I was feeling good, I was going to keep that up the whole time. And I successfully completed the 50K using that strategy.
Love it.
And not being destroyed.
Love it.
And what I figured out along the way is that I could actually walk really strong.
Yeah. This is where it started.
This is where it started. So I've become a professional, for lack of better terms, a walker, a fast packer. Mm-hmm. Like I can move under my own power, sometimes faster than people can, you know, run up a hill. I can march up it.
And I will vouch for that 100%. And I think this is great too, because, you know, there's so much talk, and what really gets me is, you know, I belong to like most people, a lot of running Facebook groups. And what really gets me is the discussion about you're not a runner unless you run the whole thing. It's just like, I just think that's total bullshit. And like nobody benefits from that line of logic. And even if that's what you think, I can guarantee you that those people that are saying those things, that's not how they trained. Like they didn't, I mean, unless they're just a superhuman specimen, they didn't just decide they were going to run one day and then fully run a 50K without ever walking. I mean, so
no,
I just want to kind of like,
not.
I'm so excited that you brought this up because I want to kind of put that theory to bed. I want to like give people permission to walk as much as they want, to incorporate walking. Like all of the athletes that I work with and most of the athletes that I know do large chunks of walking. It's a huge part of their training. And to be perfectly honest, it's like the linchpin in my own training and my own race strategy. I mean, that's, you know, you alluded to it earlier that like you showed up at the finish line not totally shattered, which is like my number one goal for not only myself but all of my athletes too. So
I have to be able to, you know, especially at that time because I was still working full time as a police officer, so I had to be able to do these races and then be able to go back to work.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, like
a bunch of time off to recover my body to be fit enough to go back to duty.
Yeah. So, how did you manage that?
So for me, it was, you know, again, training for race day. And the other thing I figured out was not to cram it all in. So I have conservatively, I tend to run really long training plans. So if I'm going to do, and we could talk about it because I did a 50K this year that I developed myself, but I gave myself almost 5 months to train for it, which was, some people might think was excessive, but for me, it allowed me to have an appropriate ramp up so that by the time my race day came along, I was conditioned and, you know, I was able to go out and enjoy it. And then, you know, the next day I had a level of soreness that I'm now accustomed to.
Yeah.
But 2 days later, I could hop back on the bike or, you know,
go back to work,
get back into some level of work.
Yeah. I think like that's another thing that I'm super into as well. Just the length of the training plan, you know,
yep.
you guys that are listening to this on audio, like I was doing a little dance over here when Heather said you can't cram for it, because that's actually like one of my fundamental beliefs is that you can't cram for an ultra. And anyone who does try to jam it into, you know, 12 or even 16 weeks, you're really setting yourself up for injury or burnout or, you know, any other host of things that could come along in that. And so I'm more of a fan of stretch it out,
yep,
you know, make it 5, 6, even 7 months, where at the beginning mm-hmm. is just this kind of, to put it in kind of technical terms, like anatomical adaptation, like getting your body ready to do the thing. And I think a lot of times we don't spend enough time in that phase. We're just like, we get excited. We signed up for this cool race where, you know, it's our first or our farthest race. So we're just super psyched. We want to get started. And we just immediately go off like a rocket. And then only to, you know, to continue with the rocket analogy, like fall back to earth almost, you know, within a few weeks or months,
right,
where you've got that burnout or you're starting to feel different, like aches and, you know, creaking and stuff happening, stuff that you've never experienced before. And you're just like, oh, I'm not cut out for it. Well, not at this pace, like not at this speed. Like if we stretched it out a little bit, I have no doubt that you'd be successful, but you're trying to cram all of this into this tiny little window. And it's no wonder like shit's going sideways.
I think it's important too to point out, like the training plan was 5 months long, but I don't ever actually stop moving. But what I do is I like to look at it as like periodization. So I will focus on, you know, a training plan, call it 5 months, for a particular event. But after that event's over, I'm still lifting. I'm still riding the spin bike. I'm still riding my mountain bike. I'm still hiking. So I have a base level of fitness that I try to hang on to all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you're incorporating all of those other modalities, not to cut you off, but like, that's the other thing is people are always like, I can only run. Like if I'm running this race, then I've
been there. Disaster.
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah. Like it is, it is huge a disaster because you're just putting too much stress on your system. And you just get into that narrow mindset of I'm a runner. I must run. Mm-hmm. You know, my other pet peeve is, people either other, you know, books or free plans, or even, I've even seen some coaches do this and it's not appropriate in all situations, but like having athletes run 5, 6, and 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And,
good point.
And doing nothing else. I mean, like, you know, there's no time in your plan for strength and mobility or cross training or just like sleeping, like having, you know, like living your life. So, you know, that's been a huge focus for me in the last couple of rounds of my group coaching program. It's just like, let's kind of break down all of these myths about what a training plan should look like. And I'm doing air quotes, so you guys can't see me, but you know, what should it look like and how can we make it? And to your point, like, how can we make it fit you as an athlete versus just, you know, downloading the rote plan off the internet and trying to conform yourself to it, which I think is a total recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. So. I mean, you had asked early on about the progression of distances and, you know, I did the 50K at Pineland, and I remember the moment that I passed the marathon mark during that race. I was like, yay, I did my first marathon. And, you know, at that point I was hooked and I had decided that at that point I wanted a 100-miler before I turned 40.
Yes.
So I employed the assistance of a coach in order to help me because I had no idea what I was doing at that point. Like 50K, I got it. Like that was manageable for me. Mm-hmm. But 100 was a completely different beast. And even with a 100-mile training plan, I wasn't running or, you know, I wasn't doing time on my legs more than 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. There was rest built into that. There were doubles built into that so mm-hmm. that I could capitalize on rest. And it was there was a lot of cross training in there too. Mm-hmm. And I was specifically training for walking because those miles after, you know, mile 60, after mile 70, you know, when the wheels come off the bus,
yes,
you're walking.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you said that too. Cause like, that's another thing. People are like, oh, you're going to run the whole thing. And I'm like, no, like if mm-hmm. we went back and looked at my Garmin data, you'd probably see that I walked a lot. I walked a lot my first attempt when I had to tap out at 75 miles. And then I walked a lot on my second attempt when I did actually finish. And you know, it was, I'm being 100% honest right now in the late stages of the race, probably like after 75, because that had been the longest I'd gone before. I did channel my inner Heather and like tried to do the fastest power walk that I could manage in that moment. I was just like, how fast would Heather walk right now?
And that's like just all keep on trucking.
I was doing. Yeah. Well, and it's funny. It's a funny story. So we have a mutual friend, Tom Hooper, who is a race director mm-hmm. for another race that we'll talk about in a second, the Ragged 75 stage race, which I've talked about extensively on this podcast. And I saw Tom that day at Ghost Train on like within my last, I think, 10 miles of 100. So I was within like really within striking distance. I had my pacer with me. We had just come from the start finish. So I had passed by my tent. My husband had made me a cup of coffee, which I hadn't had caffeine in over a year. That's a whole separate story. Ooh. But like, so right. Like you're like, ooh, it was rocket fuel to me. And so, and I was just like moving, and my pacer and I, we were like having a good time, like talking. And
that's a fun race.
It is a fun race. And I saw Tom and he was pacing somebody else. And he looked at me and he was like, how do you look this good right now? Like you look like you're out on a trip to Bed Bath and Beyond. That's like legitimately what he told me. And I was just like, I'm just channeling my inner mother. Mm-hmm. I'm just power walking. Like that's what you got to do.
Years ago, Tom dubbed me the bulldozer because I put it into low gear and I just go.
Yes. 100%.
And it works.
It totally works. And like, that's, you know, one of the strategies that I have tried to impart on my athletes that are going to do Ragged and just all of my athletes is that like, you know, forward motion.
Exactly.
It's not to be discounted. Like if you're struggling in air quotes, like if you're just, you know, not capable of running, walk it. And I taught them and you'd be surprised, but like, there's a couple different speeds to walking. And here's how I explain it to people. Yeah. Like there's like walking your dog, like leisurely, you know, walking your dog. There's like, I'm out on a walk, you know, for some cardio. And then there's like power walking, which I would equate to like Heather walking. There's power walking. And you'd be surprised. People are just like, oh, I'm going to walk. And I'm like, well, what speed? And they're like, I don't know. Just walk. I'm like, no, there's speeds. There's different
Absolutely.
Speeds. And you need to,
definitely.
In order to do an ultra, in my mind, I think you should master the different speeds. Like you shouldn't just have one speed. You should know, you know, how fast can I go right now, given how I feel and what I know to be true about the course ahead of me, you know?
And it really is different muscles. So if you don't work both sets of muscles, mm-hmm. You're not really capitalizing on your ability to be able to power walk.
100%.
So you did bonded over the walk.
I know. I mean, the walking, it's not to be discounted. Don't underestimate it. It's a serious skill. I always tell people it's like, it's the secret sauce to a lot of being able to finish an ultra, and people don't train it. And I write a lot of it into my own training plans and with my athletes. Like I've had people that have come to like, I've written plans for, and some of the very first workouts, I can remember one client way back in the day, she opened up her plan, like maybe at the first couple of weeks. And she wrote me an email. She's like, what the fuck is this? Like there is walking on my run train. I'm like, get used to it, lady. Like you're going to see a lot of this.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And down the line, like after she finished her race, she came back, she wrote me an email and she's like, I'm sorry that I doubted you. Like it totally makes sense now. Like I mm-hmm. get it. So.
Oh yeah. And if you haven't been there, it's hard to understand how it makes a difference, but any amount of movement will keep you getting closer and closer to the finish line. And it's better for the brain. Mm-hmm. to stay moving. Don't sit down.
Don't sit down. Don't stop. Just, you know, keep moving, like on to the next, like what's yeah. next, you know, keep moving. So you made it 100 miles. What race did you do that?
Vermont 100 in nice. 2017.
Cool.
And I made my goal. I managed to get it done before I turned 40.
Yes.
And that course is just wonderful. It's a lot of dirt road, mm-hmm. With some flowy single track and, you know, again, training in the environment that is going to, you know, simulate your race day. So I did a lot of dirt road training, mm-hmm. As well as some pavement, because those dirt roads get really hard. And what we found that year is they were like concrete. Mm-hmm. So the pavement training, even for a dirt trail ultra, paid off for that mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And a lot of people, I think in theory, they know that they're supposed to train similar conditions. But I think they don't recognize to what extent that's going to benefit them. You know, like, oh, I'm going to do a trail run. I'll just run the, you know, the rail trail or, you know, the dirt roads around my house. It's like, unless you know that that's an apples to apples comparison, you're probably going to have a rude awakening on race day when you show up and it's single track and there's rocks and roots or technical, like, you know, it's off camber, like all these possible things. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And dirt roads for sure can be deceiving. The other thing I want to point out too is this was my experience at Ghost Train, because if you're familiar with that race, it's pretty much flat with the exception of like one little bump that I'm hesitant to even call it a hill, because I think the total elevation gain is probably 200 feet, maybe. I don't even know. And people are always like, oh, that's going to be so great. It's flat. No, my friends, like flat races, I think are way harder.
They're brutal
because you never get a break. You don't get a break. Yeah. You don't get to climb. You don't get to descend. You're basically just using those walking muscles, those walking / running muscles, and you don't get that break. So that is definitely, like after I do my next race, that's going to be my, basically we're just going to do flat. We're going to do flat for a long time. It's going to be so boring, but I'm going to do flat.
Yeah. But you need to do it.
I have to do it. And that's like, yeah. that is part of race strategy. I think people, don't quite think about that in terms of strategy. You just kind of think, oh, I'm going to show up, I'm going to run, and I'm going to finish, or maybe not.
Right.
But there is some gamification, some game planning, some strategy that you have to think about when you're going to tackle these races, and then kind of work backwards into your training so that come race day, you're better equipped to handle whatever shows up in front of you.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was training for Vermont is really when I discovered that I am more of a process person than a race person. I adore the process. I love having a schedule. I love the milestones. I'm also the kind of person that if something goes wrong, I like to think my way through it and try to figure out what I can do to make it better. So for me, while the race day is so important, I learned a few years ago to embrace the process, because you can't pick your weather on race day. You don't know how your stomach's going to feel. It might have been perfect through your entire training, but it could be completely off the rails for half of your race. And you have no way of predicting that.
Mm-hmm. So I love the process too.
Is definitely what I fell in love with. And I think that's where the adventure piece came from for mm-hmm. me is, what kind of adventures can I create that are part of that process? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I love the process part too. And I think what saddens me the most with runners and ultra runners, just runners in general, I guess, is when they put all their eggs into the race day basket, and then something happens that, you know, derails them. It could be small, could be big, you know, and then they either pull back and they don't continue, or they consider themselves a quote unquote failure because that one effort didn't go the way it was supposed to. And I think one of the biggest lessons that I've personally learned over the course of doing all of these races and to be honest, like I haven't really done all that many races, but I've put in mm-hmm. a lot of training time.
Sure.
And that is even more important, partially because I just like the process, but those I consider to be reps, right? Like you're going out, you're doing the long runs. That's your time to practice your gear and your nutrition and all of these things. And so for me, it's less about, I could really care less. I'm much in the same boat as you in terms of like pace and my outlook on the races. Like, I could honestly care less about racing per se. Yeah. And I'm more about like the experience of the day and like, okay, I'm going to go the farthest maybe. For me, it's mostly far. I'm not really all that much about speed, but
yeah, sure.
And that's,
but that's a personal goal.
Right. Yep. And that's what bums me out. I think to just circle it back, like bums me out when people are like, oh, I didn't achieve the race. It's like, well, yeah, but like how, you know, look back on your process. Like, what did you achieve over the course of those months or whatever to get you to this day? Like, it's not all for naught because you didn't finish or because you didn't get your time or whatever it was. Like, you did all of this work to get you here. Like, that should also be celebrated. And then you, every step of the way, you hopefully you learn something that you can then take forwards and apply to whatever else you want to do next. So it's not just the one thing that you didn't get. It's how you did throughout the whole process.
Right. Hold on, I mean, and let's be realistic here.
Yes, they need to eat. Sorry, time to feed the dogs.
That's the real life stuff right there.
We are pausing for 1 second to feed the dogs.
So I was going to say, so let's be realistic here too. Over the course of an entire training process, you have life you have to deal with. Uh-huh. And life throws you curveballs. And it's going to derail your training. And there's going to be times when you have to miss a run or have to miss a workout because, you know, something has come up. Uh-huh. And you have to celebrate the successes of getting through that too and getting to race day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's rolling with the punches and realizing that it's all part of that process.
Yeah, that's funny because I was just having some conversations with some of my athletes, like one-on-one athletes and like in the group. And it's a very common theme. And one of the things I try to teach them is like, well, just how quickly can you get back on the horse, to use a equine analogy that you love so much? Like, how quickly can you just get back up on the horse? Like, okay, it happened. We could waste a lot of time bitching and moaning about it, or like, you know, beating yourself up over it, maybe even potentially circumstances that you couldn't control, or we could just like see it for what it is and then, okay, learn from it. Like, could you see what led to that? Was it controllable? Okay, great. Do that next time, or like control it better next time. Let's just get right back on the horse and keep going, because there's going to be interruptions. And it's less about the fact that there are interruptions and more about the fact that you just got to roll with the punches, like you said, get back on the horse and keep going.
Keep moving.
Okay. So kind of in that spirit, 100 miles is the furthest that you've gone?
Yes.
Okay. And then, so, but you've got some cool stuff like lined up in the future. Like, what are you working on these days? I've heard like rumblings about this, so I'm interested. I want to like get the whole lowdown on what you're planning next.
Yeah. So, since you already brought up Ragged, we should bring it up.
Yes.
So,
let's talk about Ragged.
I did the stage race, in 2019, 2018 was a personal year that was just a disaster for me. So 2019 gave me something to focus on. So I decided to sign up for Ragged after years of volunteering on the course and knowing the course really well. So what that did for me was spark this idea that if I could do this big back-to-back mileage over the course of a stage race, there was no reason why I couldn't translate that to a the through hiking concept. And we happen to have a 180-mile trail in New Hampshire called the Coos Trail, and it's COHOS, and it runs from Crawford Notch to the Canadian border. So it was a trail that I became familiar with a couple of years ago, and it had been on my radar that I wanted to do it. I don't have the ability in my life to pack everything away and go do the Appalachian Trail for 6 months, but this was something that I could bite off. And I could train for it, and I knew what it felt like to do big mileage day after day, which is what we learned how to do with Ragged. So this year, I made the decision last fall that I was going to train for hiking the Coos Trail from start to finish in one push. So I've been building my entire training plan since the snow started flying at the end of last year to this time. So I'm down in my taper, so to speak, to start hiking the Coas Trail on August 10th. So I've decided that I'm going to hike it from northbound to southbound. So I'll be what you call a SOBO hiker, S-O-B-O. So I'll be a southbound hiker, mm-hmm. and I will start at the Canadian border, and I'm going to hike my way back into the White Mountains, which is really where my heart is. I love our mountains. And the idea of hiking down into those mountains is just incredibly exciting to me.
Yeah, that would be so much fun. And so this is known as an FKT, right? You're trying to do it for a fastest known time. So this might be a new concept for some people. So can you kind of give us like the FKT primer? Like what's the deal with this?
Sure. So there is a website called fastestknowntime.com, and it's a compilation of routes across the world that people have laid down a fastest effort on. And it's a scoreboard. It's a way of keeping track of various efforts. And they have a couple of different classifications. So if we were to take a look at the Coas Trail, for instance, and we were to apply the classifications of the fastest known time to it, you have self-supported, which is one category. So that would mean if I was going to do self-supported, I would have to carry everything that I need on my back. With the exception of water, you're allowed to pick up water, filter water, public sources, that sort of thing. But I'd have to carry it all for, we'll call it 10 days. And I can't accept help from anybody. I can't have pacers, nothing. The next category would be, so it's unsupported. The next category would be self-supported, which is the route that I'm going. So it allows me to cache food. I can use, you know, I can go into stores. I can book a room and take a shower one night if I want to. And it means that I'll be able to get away with only carrying about 5 days of food on my back. And then picking up a resupply halfway through and then completing it. So my goal is to do this in 10 days. No woman has put a fastest known time down for the Coas Trail.
I just want to pause on that for a second because that is cool, right? And so can you talk about, there are male and female categories for all of these?
There are.
Are there different age groups too, or just male, female?
No, just male, female, and mixed gender team.
Oh, cool.
So you can do a mixed gender team as well. And I forgot to mention the third category would be supported. So this is those attempts like Scott Jurek did on the AT.
I was just
going
to say that. I was like thinking, yeah. I'm like, who do I know that did an FKT? Like, Scott Jurek.
So Scott Jurek started in Georgia, ended in Maine, and his wife crewed him the whole way. So the supported way is obviously the lightest, the fastest way possible. I would expect that if I had that ability, I could shave that 10 days down. But because I'm going to be carrying, you know, half of what I need, along with everything I need for a daily basis to include my shelter, my food, my sleep system, my cooking system, it's all going to be on me at all times.
So how much are you anticipating that that pack is going to weigh?
My pack is 24 pounds without my food cache. So I'm guessing I'm going to be somewhere between 30 and 32. I've done a few test hikes with it in an overnight to see how it shook out. So my goal is to get it as close to 30 as possible with my water weight. So 24 is with water, not without 5 days worth of food.
Nice. Yeah. And so what's your plan for sleeping? Are you going to like try to push through the nights? Like talk about your strategy for how you're going to tackle this.
So my strategy is to give my body what it needs. I'm looking at this as an opportunity to put down a first time, in that self-supported category. And then to really figure out what can I do better? Do I want to go back and do it again? And to not wreck my body. So one of the things I've been doing to train for it is a lot of elevation gain. So I've been averaging 15,000 feet of gain a month, along with the cross training that I've been doing, because I need to be able to climb. And that should mean that my body will hold up better, that I will get better quality sleep, because I'm not going to be destroyed every night that I lay myself down in my tent. And I should be able to get moving again the next day, knowing I'm going to be sore. Things are going to hurt.
Yeah.
I think sleep is critically important to be able to have long days on the trail.
Yeah, For sure. So how much overall elevation gain are you going to have from north to south?
I actually have no idea. I can tell you, I previewed the Kilkenny Ridge a week and a half ago. And that section of trail is 25 miles. It's on the Coos Trail. And that was 7,400 feet of gain. Just that one section.
Side note, I'm really interested in doing, I really wanted to do that race, the Kilkenny Ridge race. I think it's going on 2 years now. I think it actually conflicts with Barkley in some way, shape, or form.
Oh, yeah.
But like, I've heard good and terrifying things about that race because
it's terrifying.
Yeah, because the course is so extreme. I think not to derail your conversation, but I think one of points on maybe it was Ultra Sign Up or in an email or something, it's like you need to be prepared to like sleep overnight should you get lost and we have to come and look for you because it is so remote.
Yeah, for sure. Like you need to have a bivy sack and some warm layers because it not only is it remote, but it's really there's sections of it. I like to say the middle section. So we're talking from Stark to Jefferson. That middle section is not very well maintained. And there's a lot of blowdowns and there's a lot of, you know, climbing over trees. And I came out of there bruised to shit. That's part of the game. But again, it's part of the allure. It's part of the adventure. I would definitely recommend you go out and check out that section
beforehand. Oh, yeah. Oh,
it's amazing. Before
I take on that race, I will definitely, it's not like, so I never ran any part of Ragged before I did it. I kind of, because it is fairly close to me and you, I just kind of assumed that it was very similar to the trails that I have around here.
Sure.
And I was right. But that one for sure, I think I would want to go and preview ahead of time.
Yeah, for sure. And that actually is going to be one of the toughest sections of trail. And I'm glad that I previewed it because water is going to be an issue out there. So I'm going to end up leaving Stark where I'm going to resupply. So once I hit Stark, I'm going to have about the first 100 miles under my belt. So I'm going to hit my resupply box, which there's a lodging campground right near the trail that's going to hold my box for me. But I'm going to be going into the Kilkenny Ridge with a lot of water and 5 days worth of food. So not only is it the trickiest section, but I'm also going to be at my heaviest weight my pack will be at during that point. So
one of the things that some of the questions that I have gotten in the past about some of the races that I've done, particularly like Ghost Train, you know, moving overnight and being out in the dark overnight, and some questions that I have gotten about just generally running by yourself. These kind of, I know that there are people out there that are going to be interested to, especially women, know how you are going to do that. Like, you know, being out there by yourself in the dark, you know, how do you train for that? Like how did you get so tough to, you know, feel comfortable doing that?
So for me, it's repetition, right? So spending a lot of time in the woods, quite frankly, having animal encounters. I've had, a number of encounters with bears, and I've gotten kind of used to how do our black bears in New Hampshire behave. I would be more leery about animals than I am people, quite frankly, where we live anyway. So it's being smart. It's doing your research. So knowing the areas that you're going to be walking through, I'm not planning on hitchhiking at all. which is a through hike thing. But I'm not interested in doing that. For me, protection comes in a couple of different forms. I carry poles, and poles are a great way to make yourself look bigger than you are when you come across animals, who might not move out of the way right away. I carry a whistle, so it's a good way to make a lot of noise. I carry a knife mostly because stuff breaks, or you know, you never know what kind of situation you're going to get into. But I think the biggest peace of mind for me is I started carrying a spot tracker. So it's a GPS tracking device that I started using last year because I do hike alone in remote areas. So It was peace of mind for me, peace of mind for my husband. This little device not only allows me to turn it on so that anyone I give the link to can see where I am, but it allows me to push out messages. So it allows me to push out predetermined messages. For instance, I'm still out adventuring. Everything's going well. I'm in camp for the night. And then there's two emergency options. There's one that's, I like to refer to it as, don't send the chopper, but I need some help.
Yep.
So that one is, please check my location, and start help my way. And the reason it's set up that way is because, you know, I also look at it as being able to use it when I'm driving and I don't have cell service.
Yeah.
So if I blow a tire and I need help or I get into an accident, I can use my device.
Yep.
And then there's the SOS button, which is my, you know, the worst day happens.
Call in the
and I have to hit the button.
Yeah.
And fishing game and my husband are getting called.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I have a spot too. And I think it's probably the exact same one. And I have found it extremely helpful just for peace of mind, especially where
for sure.
We live in a place where there isn't always going to be cell phone service. And a large majority of the time, that's probably true. So just to be able to, as long as you can get a halfway decent view of the sky, have the ability to, you know, send those messages and be able to, you know, get somebody to you, and have that peace of mind.
Yeah, definitely. And I think all in all, it's just developing the confidence. So putting yourself through the situations, you know, if you have a desire to backpack and stay outside overnight, do it with somebody the first few times. Get used to what the night sounds like and figure out what your comfort level is. And if it's not for you, that's okay. If going solo is not your game, then that's okay. But just be aware of, you know, what can I do to protect myself if I need to? And how can I reach my loved ones if something goes wrong? If I've taken every precaution, I'm diligent about carrying, I carry a bivy sack year round. A bivy sack is something I can climb into if I get cold or I get injured. I carry a first aid kit every time I'm out solo, and most of the time when I'm out with other people. So again, that keeping with they call it the 10 essentials. Fishing Game is really good about listing what those 10 essentials are, but carry them. Mm-hmm. And it will give you peace of mind, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things that I've experienced is I'll show up to a trail run with friends, and it's just out of reach here, but I always have my vest, my running vest that, you know, I'm capable of carrying 2 liters worth of water. I've typically got my little thing of pepper spray. I have a knife. I've got, you know, my little first aid kit. I'm like thinking in my head, like what else is in there, but you know, I'll show up to just like a basic trail run and I've got this thing and people are looking at me like, how far are you going? I'm like, you never know. Like it doesn't matter.
Know.
Like, and typically like I'd probably have the spot. I wouldn't turn it on necessarily, but I would have it with me so that, you know, should something happen. Like the worst thing in my mind is that I think I can attribute this to being one of the oldest of 4 kids growing up with parents who were always like, you need to be prepared. And so I leave the house, you know, there's been some memes that I've seen recently of like women specifically can't leave the house with all of this stuff. And I just extrapolate that to me and like my event planning background where like you need to have all of the scenarios gamed out and you've got to have all your stuff. And then I extrapolate that to my running. And now here I am, I'm like fully packed for a weekend, but it's just like a 10K trail run or whatever it is, but I'm totally prepared. So like,
yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's important too. Like just hearing that, you know, especially for anybody, not even necessarily women, if you are wanting to get into trail running, like there are some things that you can do to keep yourself safe and to be well prepared. I think one of the hangups is, oh, I'll be in the woods. It's unknown. I might be by myself. What do I do? And it's just like, you could start to build that confidence by, you know, going to a group trail run and then getting more reps in, so to speak, on how to be on the trails. But then, you know, start to, like you're saying, figure out what works for you in terms of what do you feel like you need in order to be competent and capable out there, and then just start carrying it and like get some reps in and use it. And like, you don't just go from being a road runner, like a full-time road runner, to running trail ultras without a lot of this stuff that you're talking about in the middle. Just these repetitions and the, you know, the slow accumulation of some of this gear. You don't necessarily need all of it per se right out of the gate, but you do need to be prepared, and that's part of the process.
Oh yeah, definitely. You figure out along the way what you need for your own level of comfort. And I always think too, like, what if someone else needs it?
Yes.
And you know, one of the things I added in the last 2 years is I carry a Katadyn water filter, because I've run out of water before and that sucks. So if there's a stream there, I can filter the water. It's not going to look pretty, but it will be drinkable. And on your point, I, even to this day, I always leave my itinerary with someone.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It doesn't matter if I'm running from my house and using my local trails. I'm going to leave a note for my husband if I know he's going to be home soon, or I'm going to text a friend and say, this is where I'm going to be. So that somebody knows where I am. And I wear a road ID bracelet. Mm-hmm. So
ooh, yeah, good one too.
If for whatever reason I become incapacitated, somebody can identify me mm-hmm. and get me some help.
Yeah, so. Those are two really good points. Like my husband is actually just out. He left right before we hit record here, and he's going on a group ride. But every time he leaves the house to go on a bike ride, where are you going? Just like generally tell me where you're going. What bike are you riding?
Yeah, because itineraries change, which is why I got the spot device.
Right. Right. Like just generally, is it road or trail or like cross bike? Like what bike are you riding? Like generally, where are you going? And then how long are you going to be out? Generally, you know, it's not like I'm giving him the fifth degree. It's like, if, you know, if I get down to work, he goes out for a ride and I look up 3 hours later and he's still not home. Like, you know, I need to be able to relatively locate him. And it's the same thing is true for me. Like we have the same system. I'll tell him where I'm going, how long I'm going to be. You know, I always have my phone with me so he can, we use the like Find Me app or whatever, like he can look. And if he can't see me, you know, he'll text me or I'll have the spot. I don't run the spot every single time I'm going out, but you know, that plan I think is gives you peace of mind, gives other people peace of mind. Mm-hmm. And for sure, it will start help to you a lot faster if something were to happen than, you know, just like, hey, I'm going for a run. Bye. See you later. And just them having to randomly locate you if you have your phone and if you have good cell signal.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So you're doing the FKT. You hope to do it in 10 days.
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
That is the goal. In above all else, the beauty of not having another female on the board yet is I get to set the benchmark. And once I do that, I don't ever come off the board. So, you know, I plan to be flexible. So we talked about sleep. If it's hot during the day, and I think it's a good time for me to stop. And the beauty of this trail is the whole northern section, they have beautiful shelters. So if I want to pull off trail and hang out in the shelter for a couple of hours and then hike into the dark, then I can do that. So I plan to be flexible with that. I still have no idea what the weather is going to throw at me.
And whatever it says today, it's not going to be like that by the time you get there. So.
Exactly. So, and, you know, I've done everything I can to prepare for it. So it's just a matter of, you know, let's start the clock and see what happens.
I love that. I think that's a good outlook to kind of have on your race in general. Because definitely. One of the things that comes up in a lot of conversations that I have with runners and ultra runners is how do you prepare for a race? And it's like there are so many possible permutations that you couldn't ever plan for all of it. I mean, the best laid plans, I think one of the best skills that you could have if you're thinking about doing ultras is kind of what you said, is to be flexible, but also not to get, you know, to try to be very even keeled, because what's happening right now in the moment, whether it's a low or a high, it's going to change. Just give it X amount of time, it's going to change, and it could swing to the, you know, the pendulum could swing all the way to the other side or partway. And you really have to, I go back to that analogy, just like be super even keeled, because if you allow yourself to vacillate between the super high highs and the way low lows, it's going to be a much more difficult run or race if you just can't regulate yourself and like deal with what's happening right now. Like, don't worry about 50 miles from now or even 5 miles from now. Like, make the best decision that you can right now, given the information and the situation, and then on to the next thing. Like, don't worry about that over there. Focus right here. Like, what can you exactly do right now?
Well, yeah. And on that point, one of the biggest things that I've learned is, you know, only evaluating what I can control. And sometimes the only thing you might be able to control is your breathing. Mm-hmm. And using your breathing to calm yourself down and realize that it's not the end of the world, that things could look different in 20 minutes.
Oh yeah. And they probably will. And then you have to don't work yourself up about what could potentially happen in 20 minutes. Just deal with it when it comes up. You know, there's definitely things that you want to be proactive about, like hydration, nutrition,
sure,
clothing, like hot spots, you know, that kind of thing. Weather, you know, for you, I'm thinking like on this FKT attempt, like, you know, seeing the clouds rolling in, you know, being smart about those things. But then there's just going to be all sorts of stuff that you can't possibly plan for, but you have to be, I don't think you necessarily have to be a good problem solver. You just have to be open to the idea that you're going to be confronted with things that you have to solve for in the moment and not lose your mind over it. I don't know how
else to put it. And the more you practice, the more stuff is going to get thrown at you and you'll be able to dig deep and draw off of that experience to work through it.
Yeah. That totally goes back to, you know, trying to replicate a lot of what you're going to face on race day or during an FKT in your training. I was just talking to another client before we hit record here, and we were basically saying, like, you know, when you show up on race day, you kind of want to feel like, oh, I got, like, this is easy, you know, compared to what you've done in your training, because
it
hasn't been relatively hard. Like, I'm not saying you should blow yourself up during training, because that's not productive, but, you know, you need to be exposing yourself to some pretty difficult at that moment challenges so that you can keep continuing to move forward. And if your training was really a breeze and you show up on race day, you're probably going to be in for a rude awakening.
Yep. Agreed. For sure. Definitely.
Okay. So I think what we should do is probably make plans to chat after you finish your FKT, because
it'll be fun to talk about, for sure.
Yeah. So many stories, I'm sure.
You'll get to hear about the animal encounters, whether or not I went crazy after 4 days by myself in the woods.
Yeah, that's a big one too. You know, I think a lot of people that you hear stories about you hallucinating during longer events, like 100 miler, 200 milers, or some of these overnight, you know, like FKT things. Like, have you had that happen before? Hallucinations?
Yep. I saw a baby hippo in a puddle during Vermont.
I love it.
And that again is another reason why sleep is going to be important on this one, because this trail is also, it's marked, but it does take some navigational skills in order to stay on track. So I have to have my faculties about me.
Yeah.
And without the benefit of a pacer, then it's all going to fall on me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the last thing you want, is to be sleep deprived, make a wrong turn, and then end up in who knows where, you know?
Right. Yeah. And it, you know, that could be the difference of adding 5 or 10 miles onto an already, you know, triple digit effort. So
yes, for sure. Going back to hallucinations, back in Ghost Train a couple years ago, I didn't really have too many, like visualizations, like a baby hippo in a puddle. Mine weren't that cool. Mine were just basically that, like, all of the things around me were moving. It was just like, it was almost like a Disney or a Pixar movie where inanimate objects come to life, and they're you know, so like the
branches, like the trees are dancing.
And like, I didn't get any like cartoon faces, but things just were moving in ways that you don't normally see them move. I was just like, this is weird. I have no idea what's happening. And I could recognize the fact that I was hallucinating and like definitely sleep deprived, but I was just like, wow, this is what it's like. Okay.
Oh yeah. To dig into those other depths of your brain.
And 4 days by yourself too, like overnight running, you know, 100 miles is one thing. But multiple days back to back, I'm going to be curious to hear about that from you, from your perspective, just like what it was like, how you dealt with it, like what were some of your strategies, you know, the whole
thing. I'll take some notes along the way. Ooh, that way so I can organize my thoughts.
Journal. Yes. Bring a journal. Yes, I totally would.
Like, for sure.
I used to keep a journal back in the day when I worked events and did a lot of traveling. I'll be 100% honest. There were days I woke up in hotel rooms and I had no idea what city I was in. Because I'd been, you know, I lived on the road for a very long time. So part of the point of the journal was just like to keep me grounded. Okay. Today I'm in Cleveland. Tomorrow I'm in, you know, wherever, Columbus, wherever it was. And I stopped doing it for a period of time. And I totally wish I had kept it up because now I can go back and look at all of those things. And there are experiences and things that I had written down that I don't remember, but it obviously happened because I wrote it down. It was like part of the journal. Yeah. And so I think it's interesting. It would definitely be interesting to have that perspective for a longer, you know, FKT event like this to be able to see, okay, today and to demonstrate, well, today the morale was high. Today, yesterday, not so much. Like, you know, just see this
thing. The trail is, it's going to fling what it wants to fling at me. And it's, again, it's either going to light a fire for me to continue to do these long multi-day efforts, these longer backpacking efforts where I'm literally relying on myself for everything that I have. Mm-hmm. Or I might come out of it and be like, you know what? One and done.
and that's fine too, you know?
Like exactly.
Be able to be the coolest part about this, I think, is that you're, like you said before, you're going to be the first woman to lay down a time on this trail. And then that lives on forever. And that, you know, that is super cool. So, I'm going to put those links. Heather has a bunch of links for some of the sites that she referenced. So I'm going to put those in the show notes. So if you're at all interested in like even just looking at FKTs near you or, you know, in random places, you can start to see. And, you know, this is something that I think a lot of people, I saw an uptick in FKTs during COVID, like when we were
definitely
all, because it was like the thing to do, the thing that you could do really was because since there were no races in basically most of the world. So there was an uptick in FKTs, but I think that this is something that anybody can do. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's not just for Scott Jurek, you know, it's not just for elite athletes. There are tons of athletes out there that have done these types of events, even just for the sheer act of doing it and having been on the trail and then putting down a time. It's not, you know, you don't have to come at it from I'm going to win or I'm going to be the fastest person. It can just be, you know, you trying to challenge your current boundaries or your current limitations or what you think are your limitations.
It's actually a neat way to get some ideas too for training, like take a look at what other people have done and use it as a training event and, you know, get out there and see what it's like. And the FKT site does give you parameters on creating your own segment to be able to lay a time down on.
Cool.
So again, like you had already touched on, anybody can do this stuff.
So one of the reasons that I started this podcast, like back in December, so long ago, I talk about it like it's so long ago.
You've been around the block.
I mean, you know, it's just me over here talking into a microphone. but now I get to talk to cool people like you. But one of the reasons that I started the podcast in the beginning was to, you know, share the process of, like we talked about, loving the process, sharing the process of ultra running with more women specifically, because, you know, as you know, you get to some of these races. I think part of me thinks that around here, like in this neck of the woods, we might be a little bit spoiled. Like there are quite a few women, but I don't think that there are necessarily enough women that show up to these races that are participating. And so that's, I wanted to expose more women who were on the edge or kind of like dancing around the edge of maybe wanting to do an ultra. Maybe they like have gotten, like to your point, have gotten to the half marathon distance, but they like, you know, maybe they don't love road running. That was me. Like,
sure. That was me too.
Failed. I proudly tell people that I'm a failed road runner because it just wasn't for me.
To this day, I still haven't run a pavement marathon. I'll never do that.
I love it. I love that because that, like for me, I could never break the 4 hour mark on a road marathon. And I just kept trying. And then, you know, I would see all these people
being miserable.
And all anyone ever wanted to know was, what's your time? It's like, I don't care. Like, and plus they were kind of boring for me. I mean, you're just running around the city or
for
like,
sure,
looking at pavement. I mean, the trails are so much more interesting. Anyway, but so to get more women exposed to this, to have more women hear different points of view, different what other women are doing, you know, to be able to give, to plant the seed that, oh, like, I don't have to do it in a particular progression. I don't have to do it the way anybody else is doing it. Like, I could try this, and it could be something that I could do. And so I'm just curious that, like, what advice or thoughts or like pearls of wisdom, or like, not only for women, but for anybody, could you just like give us, if someone is listening to this and they are interested in an ultra, maybe they think they can't do it for whatever reason, we could do a whole podcast on the word.
Oh yeah,
on the word definitely can't could. And like how I want to blow that word up, but like, what advice would you give to someone who's kind of dancing around the fringes, like toying with the idea about doing an ultra?
So like I said earlier, I am like that middle of the pack, like back of the middle of the pack. And it didn't matter if I ran road or if I ran trail or if I ran mountains. That's just always where I was. And the fact of the matter is, this stuff is accessible to everybody. And if you're willing to be flexible and embrace a training plan and embrace some support from some other people that have done this. You can achieve it. I always come back to the fact that that 50K distance is actually incredibly manageable if you have a full-time job or career. I don't have kids myself, but I have plenty of friends that do have children and are able to successfully keep a base and complete that 50K distance and be creative. You talked about, you know, integrating your runs with some of your husband's rides and same thing, like there have been times I've gone to the dump with my husband and I run home from the dump. Like get your reps in any way that you can, because it is achievable and it's so fun. And it's a community that, you know, I haven't regretted a second of being part of it because it really is like a big party.
It truly is.
And nobody really cares how fast you did it. The race directors are there until you're done.
Yes. And I think that was for me the most, the most shocking isn't the right word, but like the most amazing part about the ultra and the trail running community was just that like you could show up, not know a single person. And by the end of the race, you've made five friends. They all are like, they like want your number. They want to follow you on social media. They're interested in who you are as a person. They're, if you have a problem, like if you ever had a problem in a road race, they would run you over to like just get that spot in order to finish higher than you. If you have a problem on a trail race, like the 5 to 25 closest people are going to hit pause and make sure you're okay before they take one more step just to...
They'll give up their own race to help you get through whatever you're getting through. And I think we're a community where we celebrate the back of the pack. Like everybody's at the finish line and... You know, you got there. That's all that matters is you got there.
You did the work. I think there's more of a recognition in the trail and ultra community about the fact that you did the work to get there. Like you didn't just randomly, you know, show up, you know, like you didn't just happen upon this race. Like you did a lot of work to get yourself there. And that in and of itself is worth celebrating. And then the, you know, maybe the like cherry on top is that you crossed the finish line. It doesn't really matter what time you did it in. Like, you finished. And even if you didn't finish, I can think back to, you know, some trail races that I've been at that people have elected to, you know, I've DNF'd, people have elected to pull themselves out of. And we are much more supportive. Like I would be much more supportive of somebody doing that than to use my term, just blow yourself up, which isn't a great term, but you get the point. Like, I would be more supportive of you pulling yourself out of a race versus blowing yourself up just to put up a time and get a finisher's medal and whatever. Like, that to me is totally counterproductive to why you're here in the first place. So,
And what do we say? It'll be there next year. Or, you know, the trail's still there next time. And you know, one more point is I don't have that stereotypical runner's body. Like, it's easy for me to put on muscle, but my body is just, it's, you know, I'm not skinny and svelte and that's okay. Like, again, we're a community of people that celebrate all body types and all walks of life, and everybody is here and has a story. So it's just a fun place to hang out.
I think we should end on that. I think that's a good place to put a pin in it. Well, Heather, I want to thank you for coming on and hanging out and sharing like your, you know, all your experiences, all your learnings, and kind of exposing everybody to FKTs. And we're definitely going to have to chat when you come back after you've gotten a lot of sleep and, you know, been well fed and
taken a shower. That was the one thing my husband, asked me, are you going to go the whole time without a shower?
What did you answer him?
No, I'm going to find a shower or at least a body of water.
Just at least take a dip. I mean, you know,
exactly.
How else are you going to get the true experience if you don't like really go for it, right?
Be that stinky hiker. Yeah.
I mean, that's probably the best way to replicate an AT trip, you know, just
like, exactly.
Go without showering.
No shower.
So are you going to try to post along the way, like social
I
media?
Am.
Okay. So are you cool if we share that with listeners so that they can like follow along and check up on you and send you
Do you want my handle now or are you just going to include it in the show notes?
You can give it now and I'll include it in the show notes.
Okay. Yep. So my Instagram handle is @spottedimages. So it's one word, SPOTTED images. Cause I like to take pictures. So I will, I'll be posting pictures from my journey and some stories along the way.
Are you actually taking your camera or are you just going to use your phone?
No. So I did experiment with the camera, but it weighs a bit too much and I'm honestly worried about weather. I paid a little too much money to take the risk. So it'll be just my phone this time.
Yeah. So. You guys, Heather takes some really cool pictures. So you should definitely follow not only for the pictures, but follow for her FKT journey and send her some love along the way. You know, it's always good. I always love being out on a long run or whatever. And, you know, maybe posting a random story to just get like proof of life. Like I'm still here, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And then getting some messages from people being like, you're doing great. They have no idea, but it's just, you know, it's great to get some love. Like, you know, so I'm definitely going to be stalking your Instagram page.
Thank
just
you.
To like see how you're doing and I'll send you some love, but it would be good for other people to, so what day are you actually starting again?
Tuesday, August 10th.
Tuesday, August 10th.
And I did set a hard deadline. I will get off trail August 23rd, whether I have hit my car or not. The beauty of the North Country is there is the availability to get a shuttle. Mm-hmm. There's shuttle drivers up there. So, I hit there's a hard deadline because I got to go back to work at some point.
It's a bummer. So. That whole work thing just really puts a wrench in
this. I know. This is not fun.
My goal is to get this up before that so people can follow you like beforehand so that they get a
awesome
to find you and follow along and send you some love. So
great.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Megan. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah.
Well, what do you guys think? It's pretty awesome, right? If you're curious about the world of FKTs, Heather sent me a whole bunch of links that I will put down in the show notes so you can go and check those out. Start researching your own FKT near you. And actually, one thing that she also sent to me in the follow-up email, the one with all the links in it, is that the other two people that have done this route before her have both gone northbound. So they started in the south and went up north. And she's actually going southbound. So she's going to start in the north. I know it's confusing, right? And she's going to travel south. So that means she'll actually be the first person to put up a southbound time. I know, right? She's like just setting records all over the place. Go follow Heather on Instagram @spottedimages, check her feed and her stories, send her some love while she's out there, and make sure that you're subscribed to the show so that you don't miss our next chat post FKT, because that's the one that I think is going to be really interesting. Now, during this episode, we talk about the training that's required to take on a challenge like this. And a big part of that kind of overall process is strength and mobility. Now, this is something you guys have heard me talk about a lot. And I wanted to let you know that I actually have a new program that is out. I'm super excited about it. It just went live the other day. It's called The Essentials. And it's a great place to start if you want to do more strength and mobility. So along with all those other links, I will drop this this one into the show notes for you to check out. But basically, it's a 4-week online program that walks you through the essentials of strength and mobility for runners from head to toe, literally. I've got stuff in there for head, neck, shoulders, all the way down to ankles, feet, and toes. And this is the same kind of stuff that we do in my group coaching program, Run Farther, Faster, Stronger, which you guys have heard me talk about. And going forwards, this program, The Essentials, is actually going to be the prerequisite to doing Run Farther, Faster, Stronger. So if you've had your eye on that program, you need to jump on The Essentials now. So just go to megan-gould.com/essentials. That's E-S-S-E-N-T-I-A-L-S for all the information and to snag your spot. All right, you guys. Well, that does it for this episode. Enjoy this beat, and I'll see you all soon. Thank you.